This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. Democratic presidential contenders evaluated after their first debate. Climate pushes migrants to Europe's border. A new TV program explores the human brain.
The brain contains 100 billion neurons, and every single neuron in your brain is about as complicated as the city of Houston.
An award-winning country music band tries something new. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. American political analysts and potential voters are assessing the thoughts and impact of the U.S. Democratic Party's first presidential debate of the 2016 campaign. Most opinion makers and polls say the two-hour debate held in Las Vegas, Nevada, Tuesday night largely preserved the status of the party's frontrunners, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. They were joined by three lesser-known candidates, all of them clashing over issues including gun control, economic policy, and the role of the U.S. military overseas. International Edition's Jim Stevenson spoke with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone about the debate.
I think it's helping to make Hillary Clinton once again a formidable front runner. I think some of the people in her campaign are breathing much easier the day after the debate. She gave a strong, polished performance. You know, go back to 2008, there were like 25 or so Democratic debates, and she did pretty well. So she's an experienced debater. Bernie Sanders, her main challenger, has an ability to whip up crowds with a couple of main themes, but she has a broader view, and I think that came into play during the debate. She was very strong on foreign policy issues, on the economy, but also Sanders may have handed her a gift on this whole email controversy when he said, enough with the emails, let's move on to the issues. Well, that nothing but helps Hillary Clinton. So on so many areas, I think she had a strong night. What does it all mean? I think it kind of resets that Democratic race. She'd been slipping, questions about her trustworthiness. Some of those things will still be there. It doesn't go away, and the Republicans will still have some ammunition for later on. But I think she's reset this race now. She's in charge.
Jim, what about the candidates lagging in the polls following the debate? Who might be reconsidering their run for the White House?
Well, you could argue that, I suppose. Jim Webb, Lincoln Chafee. Martin O'Malley had perhaps the strongest night of those other three, the former Maryland governor. Chafee and Webb aren't really doing much campaigning. They're not spending a lot of money. As long as they keep getting invited to the debates, they might hang in there. But it does argue for, you know, where are we going with this right now? And can Bernie Sanders expand his base beyond the sort of progressive wing of the Democratic Party? He was on the defensive a lot on economic policy, on guns. So it's a different now phase of the campaign for Bernie Sanders.
Well, now that both parties have had the public stage to answer questions, how do the Republicans stand following the debate among the Democrats?
Well, certainly I think it's going to bolster the idea that there's a good chance that the Democrat they're going to be facing is Hillary Clinton. Now, that's something they've planned for all along. Clinton did bring up the Benghazi committee, though, during the debate. There's been some controversy of late about that. Charges the Republicans are targeting her politically. She's been able to play off some remarks by Kevin McCarthy. So I think the Republicans are still aiming for Hillary Clinton down the road. But they also realize she's going to be a tough opponent if and when it comes to that in the general election.
Donald Trump has arguably been one of the most charismatic politicians in recent memory. Although he wouldn't refer to himself as a politician, he has not held public office of any kind. But in addition to being a big businessman, he's a TV celebrity thanks to his long-running program The Apprentice, and soon he's going to be hosting Saturday Night Live.
Donald Trump's had a great knack for knowing how to seize the public spotlight and keep it. And that's something he's shown throughout this Republican race so far. And I would expect it also to be a boon. You know, any politician who's willing to make fun of him or herself, it's a great asset with the public. And particularly Trump, who can come off as pompous at times, this could be a real opportunity to broaden his appeal in the sense where he could come off with a little bit of humility, and that never hurts a politician.
VOA national correspondent Jim Malone speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. One of the biggest questions surrounding the Democratic presidential race is whether Vice President Joe Biden will decide to make a late entry. The vice president has said he still has not made up his mind, but is expected to announce a decision within days. Turning to what's buzzing online about the Democratic presidential debate, here's social media correspondent G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hi, Ray.
So what is the Twitter world saying about the winner of the debate?
That's difficult to say because the internet and the pundits are saying different things.
But it's between the two contenders who are leading the polls before the debate. Is that right?
Right. It's a toss-up between former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. The U.S. News & World Report tweeted, Bernie Sanders won the Democratic debate according to the internet and shared a link to an article. Now, that article says, based on Google Trends, he was the most Googled candidate after the debate in every state and led Google search results into the morning. He was also the most discussed candidate on Facebook, followed by Clinton and Jim Webb.
So Sanders dominated the internet, but are you saying someone else was the big winner with the pundits?
Yes, Hillary Clinton is still the pundits' favorite. She had flawless performance, and like Jim said earlier, she was very polished, and you could tell she was ready to answer tough questions like her private email account and the Benghazi attack. But is all of them more important than winning the general public? Dan Pfeiffer, who used to be the senior advisor to President Obama, tweeted this. Clinton had a great night, but Sanders winning the focus group and online polls but losing the pundits is reminiscent of Obama in 2007-2008. And guess what? Mr. Obama won twice. Pfeiffer's tweet got shared almost 2,000 times and marked as a favorite more than 3,000 times. And he's on Twitter at Dan Pfeiffer. That's P-F-E-I-F-F-E-R.
I see. Are there any other tweets?
Well, some Republican contenders like Mike Huckabee and Donald Trump live-tweeted the debate and caused quite a stir with their tweets. Many people found Huckabee's tweet that insinuated Asians eat their pets to be a racist remark. On a more positive note, Bill Clinton, the former president and husband of Secretary Clinton, tweeted this. I am proud of Hillary Clinton. Tonight she showed why she should be president. That tweet was marked as a favorite more than, get this, 14,000 times. Ray?
Thanks, G. She tweets for our VOA International Edition Twitter account at VOA underscore IE. And you can also follow her on her own account at G Abby Lee. That's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. And this is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. U.S. and Russian defense officials have wrapped up a third round of talks on rules for conduct in the air war over Syria and are finalizing a memorandum of understanding that will establish basic safety rules and avoid any inadvertent collisions. The U.S. Defense Department says progress was made, which it says focused narrowly on the implementation of specific safety procedures. The Russian Defense Ministry reported a convergence of positions on key provisions of the future document. Despite all the talk, confusion remains on the ground in Syria, with U.S. and Russian involvement, and Islamic State advancing to take control of several villages near Aleppo. William Forstchen is the author of Day of Wrath, and offered his assessment of Islamic State in the Middle East to International Edition host Susan Yaki.
It's terrifying at this moment. Consider all the different forces that are involved in an area that geographically is not all that big. We have aircraft from a number of different sides that can, of course, do Mach plus speed, heavily armed. To me, it is a frightening scenario of an accidental war taking off and expanding.
What are you saying might happen?
We have some pilot who pushes the wrong button or gets a little bit too panicky at a particular moment, and suddenly we've shot down a Russian plane or they've shot down one of ours. Accidental wars, it's one of the standard ways a major war can get started, by accident. And is it being effective at all? Look at the amount of money that was spent by the United States to train, what, half a dozen fighters at $100 million apiece? We have to face the fact we're in a long-term conflict, and personally, I feel, in the end, it's going to require boots on the ground.
Obama's very much opposed to that, however.
Yes, he is, and I wish he would wake up. I had to speak frankly on that. Recall a couple years back when he referred to ISIS, or some people now call ISIL, as a JV team. I do not consider an organization that is crucifying tens of thousands of people, murdering them, beheading them. And if you want to talk about a war on women, it is happening right now in that region. Women are the greatest victims of all, women and children in this conflict.
What about the international community? What should they be doing?
A lot more than what's being done right now. There was a time when we would have stood up to what is essentially becoming a Holocaust, and it is not happening. I long for the day when we would see an organized international effort, but it simply is not happening.
What about Russia? Do you think they should pull out of the event?
I wish we could have a conversation with Putin and find out what is his hidden agenda regarding why he has placed so many assets into Syria fighting on that one particular side.
And you have a book, I've mentioned it, The Day of Wrath. Could you tell us just a little bit about it?
I wrote Day of Wrath a year and a half ago, and it was my concern about lack of security on America's borders, combined with what happened in Beslan, Russia, September 1, 2004, the Beslan incident, B-E-S-L-A-N, where extremists seized a school and murdered over 300 children. We saw it happen in Pakistan in December. We've witnessed, what, over 1,000 women and children being taken prisoner in Nigeria and disappearing. What could happen if a small, well-trained team by ISIS was unleashed on two or three American schools? It would be far more profound and culturally shocking than what happened on 9/11.
William Forstchin, author of Day of Wrath, was his analysis of Islamic State in the Middle East, speaking with my colleague Susan Yaki. There are fresh concerns about economic growth in China. VOA business correspondent Alexis Christophorus is in New York with the latest.
New data has investors worried about whether China can meet its year-end growth target of 7%. The pace of price increases in China moderated in September. China's consumer price index rose 1.6% during September compared with a 2% rise in August. The producer price index dropped 5.9% in September from a year earlier, marking the 43rd consecutive month of deflation. Some investors are banking on further stimulus from Beijing to support the economy. Some expect China to cut interest rates and the amount of reserves banks are required to hold at least once more before the end of the year. That would be on top of 5 interest rate cuts and 3 reductions to the reserve requirement ratio since November.
Senior bankers appear to be jumping ship to join Chinese technology companies. Is this a growing trend, Alexis?
In just the past 2 months, Credit Suisse head of China technology, J.P. Morgan Chase's head of China healthcare, and the head of technology, media, and telecom in Asia for Bank of America have all left their firms for Chinese tech companies. Headhunters say a combination of increased regulation, cost controls, and lower compensation is making banking jobs less attractive for some. At Chinese technology companies, billions of dollars in venture capital have led to soaring valuations and cash-rich balance sheets. Many of these companies are now looking to put that excess capital to work by making acquisitions, and that creates roles for people with banking experience. A similar trend is taking place in the U.S., where where high-ranking Wall Street executives have moved to Silicon Valley, including former Morgan Stanley Chief Financial Officer Ruth Porat, who left to take the same role at Google.
VOA business reporter Alexis Christophorus in New York. Among the many dire circumstances that are driving more than 700,000 migrants to Europe's border, political repression and war are only part of the problem. The International Office for Migration is asking what the EU countries will do with those who escape poverty created by drought and other climate changes. IOM spokesman Leonard Doyle spoke with VOA's David Arnold about the uncertain future for many of the migrants who do not qualify on political grounds.
This is what we're trying to draw attention to, is a certain core group are indeed refugees and entitled to international protection under the 1951 Convention, but there's a large group who are there through no fault of their own. They are unaccompanied minors, they are people who've been trafficked in labor or sex trade, and indeed this new group called climate migrants. So this is the danger we're drawing attention to, is they can't simply all be described as economic migrants and thereby deported. And we think that that would be a wrong-headed approach.
That then leaves the possibility that all the hundreds of thousands who have been entering Europe have a right to stay in Europe. Can Europe support that?
Well, Europe is a very large and wealthy place. It's certainly got the wherewithal to support people, far more so than the countries surrounding countries of conflict like Jordan, Lebanon, and indeed Turkey. But, of course, the politics of Europe are probably less likely to be able to support it. And that really is the issue, is how much can the politics sustain without the European politics itself becoming destabilized?
Do you think they can accept and accommodate all of those refugees politically?
I think provided they have good leadership, and in certain parts of Europe they have excellent leadership, I'm thinking of Germany and France in particular, provided they invest in good communications with their own host population, so they explain why it's important to have refugees, both for the self-interest of the people, for the wealth and diversity of the country, and indeed for purely moral grounds. Yes, they can do it, but they need to operate very carefully. They need to invest in good communication, and they need to make sure that they educate those incoming migrants.
And of the hundreds of thousands of migrants who have been descending on Europe in the last year and a half or 2 years, how many of those do you think are climate migrants?
It's a very difficult question to answer because there are many factors involved in migration, many so-called push factors. But we know that the environment is disappearing for many people, for many farmers, for example. We know that Lake Chad is now a puddle compared to a massive lake. And therefore, we know that many people have lost and are losing their livelihoods. And this expresses itself quite often in terms of civil strife. It might be Tuareg fighting with settled people in Niger. It could be even behind the war in Syria, where people have moved off the land because it's no longer supporting their families. They're in the cities, they're unemployed, and they're protesting in one way or another against the powers that be. So it's quite often difficult to say these are climate migrants, but we believe that climate is a stress factor in driving people into migration.
You mentioned West African countries. What about the rest of Africa?
We know that climate change is affecting people. How much it's affecting people remains to be quantified. And whether it's climate is the issue that tips it over the edge, or whether it's political violence or natural disasters, it's sometimes very hard to tell. Natural disasters are easier to tell. So we think it's part of the mix, and it's very much a strong driver of migration, but not the sole factor.
What will happen to some of those that politically in Europe are not going to be included? Can they be sent back home?
I think that's the danger, is that most will be sent back home, and we're just concerned that they not be sent home with too much dispatch, that they work carefully with organizations like International Organization for Migration, so that vulnerable people are protected, even if they don't fall under the specific 1951 Convention for Refugees.
That's Leonard Doyle, spokesman for the International Office for Migration, speaking with VOA's David Arnold. Coming up, a new look at the human brain. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's a glass-bottom bridge, the first in China, in central Hunan province. 180 meters high, 300 meters long, and strung between two cliffs in Shenzhou Park. It's attracting thousands of tourists every day, like Chu Zhegao.
If this is what
I'm challenging myself, he says. I just walked from over there, but I never looked down. To each his own to find the way across. Hold onto the rail, grab your friend in front of you, and make a human train. Or just get down on your hands and knees if you must. And if you make it over this bridge, there's an even bigger one on the way in Hunan Province. At a planned 430 meters long and 300 meters high, the new bridge will likely be the world's tallest and longest when it opens in Zhangjiajie Park in 2016. For VOA's What's New, I'm Martin Seacrest.
This is VOA's International Edition in Washington. The U.S. Public Broadcast Service, PBS, is airing a six-part series called The Brain with David Eagleman. The famed neuroscientist from the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas, demonstrates what science has learned about the most complex thing in the known universe. VOA's Greg Flakes has more.
This is the story of how your life shapes your brain and how your brain shapes your life.
In the six-part program, David Eagleman demonstrates how our brains create what we perceive as reality and how what we are is a construct within the brain circuitry that is never complete.
We're not fixed. From cradle to grave, we are works in progress. I think what people will find here, I hope, if I've done my job right, is an inroad into understanding themselves a little bit better.
In a presentation in Houston, Eagleman spoke of his fascination with the human brain's complexity.
The brain contains 100 billion neurons, and every single neuron in your brain is about as complicated as the city of Houston.
In sample clips from his series, Eagleman showed experiments he and other researchers have done to learn how the brain works. He shows how simple actions involve many coordinated brain patterns influenced by impulses that sometimes compete.
You're made up of many different drives, all of whom are trying to be in control.
He says the conscious reasoning part of the brain sometimes struggles with the basic impulses from the larger unconscious part of the brain.
You know, when you're faced with some sort of temptation, like warm chocolate chip cookies in front of you, part of your brain wants that. Part of your brain says, don't eat it, you're going to get fat, and you can argue with yourself.
In the series, Eagleman also looks ahead to where brain research may lead in the future, and he says there's a lot more to learn.
And why do brains sleep and dream? What is intelligence? How do you build consciousness out of physical pieces and parts? Those questions are still open territory.
Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
Grammy winners the band Perry, siblings Kimberly, Reed, and Neil have been nominated for a CMA Award in the Vocal Group of the Year category. But their latest single, Live Forever, is more a pop song than their traditional Newgrass Country. International Edition's David Byrd reports that the new sound came from the band's imagination and from working with top producers Red One and Diplo.
If I die young, bury me in satin. Lay me down on a bed of roses, sink me in the river at dawn, send me away with the words of a love song.
The band Perry, lead singer Kimberly and her brothers Reed and Neil, is known for its close harmonies, strong lyrics, and its bluegrass roots. Their breakout hit, If I Die Young, is a multi-platinum single and launched the group into country music stardom. But Kimberly Perry and her brothers have departed from that more traditional sound in their new single, Live Forever.
I was dreaming of war, saw that I wouldn't die. Was dreaming of shores that my ship would find.
That new sound is a result of the group's work with Lady Gaga's producer, Red One, who also produced Nicki Minaj's Starship. Kimberly Perry says that Red One's talent for teaming gigantic melodies with powerful lyrics to produce anthem-like songs was just what the band wanted.
That was one reason that we were really excited to work with him because, of course, coming from country music, you know, country's really all about the narrative. So we were interested in putting a really narrative lyric with a gigantic melody that made everybody who heard it really want to sing along with it. And so, you know, we brought our narration into the room and Red One brought Big Melody and Live Forever was born. We're gonna live.
The group also worked with producer Diplo, who has worked with Britney Spears, Shakira, Beyoncé, No Doubt, Justin Bieber, Usher, Snoop Dogg, and Chris Brown. Neil Perry, who plays mandolin in the band, says it was an exciting change for Diplo to record the acoustic-based band.
You know, it is interesting, too, to hear how a guy who wouldn't typically record organic instruments like mandolins,
banjo,
three-part family harmony, see how he would interpret that. And I think it made for some really unique sounds that will make this next album a step up from where Pioneer was. Yeah, we're gonna live.
The band Perry has not named their new album, and they have not announced its release date yet. But Kimberly Perry has said that the group was dreaming in color when they recorded the album, and the video for Live Forever is awash in bright yellow and other neon colors. Kimberly says that brightness and excitement is an indication of the flavor that fans can look for. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, information, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
October 16th is World Food Day, a day of action against hunger. The date commemorates the founding in 1945 of the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, or FAO. On this day, people around the world come together to declare their commitment to eradicate hunger in our lifetime. Over the past decade or so, we have seen a great reduction of people living with hunger on a nearly daily basis. Back then, about 1 in 6 people went to bed hungry most nights. Now it's about 1 in every 9. Nonetheless, that still leaves some 795,000 chronically hungry people around the world. Of these, 60% are women, and this despite the fact that most small farmers living in the developing world are women. And when women go hungry, so all too often do children. About 161 million kids under the age of 5 are malnourished. This means that their brains won't develop normally. They may have difficulties learning, and their physical and cognitive growth is stunted. Lack of nutrition compromises not only their own success in the future, but also the development of the communities, economies, and countries in which they live. In addition to those children who are chronically undernourished, almost 5 million children under the age of 5 die of malnutrition-related causes every year. The global community is working to eradicate hunger because it is the right thing to do. The first of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals called for halving the proportion of people suffering from hunger and facing extreme poverty. We have achieved that goal. As we transition to a sustainable development agenda for 2030, we have raised our ambitions and are striving to effectively end hunger and extreme poverty altogether. The United States aids this effort through its innovative Feed the Future initiative. We partner with country governments, many universities, multilateral and non-governmental organizations, transnational organizations like the UN, research communities, and the private sector to lift millions of vulnerable people out of hunger and poverty. On World Food Day, the United States reaffirms its commitment to the fight against poverty, hunger, and undernutrition.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4.